This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, a prison reformer takes a look at the future of private prisons. Mumia Abu-Jamal says Hillary Clinton must be held accountable for her role in mass black incarceration. And Green Party vice presidential candidate Ajamu Baraka says the U.S. must end its policy of permanent war.
But first, two prominent civil rights organizations, the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law and the Arkansas ACLU, have teamed up to bring a class action lawsuit against the district court in Sherwood, Arkansas, for sending mostly black and poor people to debtor's prison for failure to pay fines and court fees. Kristen Clark is president of the Lawyers Committee. She says the Sherwood court's actions are unconstitutional.
The Supreme Court in 1983 issued a ruling in a case called Bearden versus Georgia that makes clear that locking people up merely because they are poor or because they are unable to pay fines or fees is unconstitutional. But what we've seen around the country is that this is big business, and that courts around the country have erected what we describe as debtors' prisons. Essentially, these serve as courts that warehouse the poor, a disproportionate number of whom are African American or Latino, and entangle them in the criminal justice system by imposing on them mounting fines or fees tied to very low-level offenses. In Sherwood, Arkansas, they maintain what's called a hot check division in their local court. And this is a local court that is all about preying on the poor. If you live in Sherwood and write a check to a local merchant turned for insufficient funds, you could be subject to prosecution within the hot check division. And one of our clients in this case well exemplifies what happens to you. One of our clients, Nikki Petrie, wrote a check for $28.93. A check was returned for insufficient funds. And over the last 5 years of her life, she has spent more than 25 days in jail and seen her debt escalate to close to $3,000. So we filed this lawsuit to bring a close to a dark era in Sherwood that has impacted tremendously the lives of black people, of poor people, of folks who never should have been entangled in the justice system in the first place.
We're told that Sherwood officials coerce folks into signing a waiver of their rights, but how can you waive a constitutional right, just as you can't waive a right not to be held in slavery?
This is a court that disregards the due process rights of individuals at every turn. Long lines form outside the courtroom where the hot check division hearings are held. People standing in line are forced to sign a waiver of their right to counsel if they want to enter the courtroom. If you come with advocates, family members, or friends, they are told that they are not permitted inside the courtroom. Essentially, these hearings are held in secret, in the dark, and people stand up with counsel by their side to help ensure that they understand their rights. And the judge who presides over this court, Judge Hale, imposes people to increasing fines and fees and requires that they appear in his courtroom over and over again. And if you fail to appear because you have a conflict with work or have been unable to secure child support, then a warrant may issue for your arrest. So this is a broken criminal justice system. And our hope is that with this lawsuit, we bring justice to the people of Sherwood, but shine a spotlight on what truly is a national racial justice issue. And the court knows that they are preying on poor people. They have targeted a vulnerable population. They have disregarded their due process rights, denied them the right to have a lawyer stand by their side to advocate in their best interest. This is a court that needs to be shut down. It's not a court of justice. It is a court that's truly preyed on the poor people of Sherwood, Arkansas.
And you've done some studies into exactly who their target market, because they act like this is some kind of business, who their target market is, disproportionately black.
That's right, and they advertise the services of this court publicly. They hold themselves out to businesses in Sherwood as a place that you can turn to. If you have somebody who's bounced a check, they refer to local merchants as the clients of the court. So this is big business in Sherwood. They've generated more than $12 million in revenue in Sherwood through the hot check court over the course of the past 5 years.
This sounds a lot like the situation that got a national spotlight in Ferguson, Missouri, which extracted much of its operating revenues from black and poor folks.
That's right. We know that this is not an isolated problem. This is a problem that we're seeing across the country. Courts that prey upon vulnerable African American, Latino, and poor communities. And we know that they operate off this system of financial incentives, and that there is much work that remains to be done to tear down debtors' prisons. And truly, when you look at this problem, this is a major contributor to the problem of mass incarceration in our country. So through our work in Sherwood, we really hope to bring justice to numerous communities across our country where there are debtors' prisons systems in place.
This is a class action suit. Do you hope to recover more than just damages, but to damage those who've inflicted this pain as well?
We do. We seek relief not just for the poor people who have been impacted by this debtor's prison, but we also seek reform. We seek to bring an end to the era of incarcerating poor people in Sherwood. Judge Miles Hale is named in our suit. We deem him to be a key culprit in maintaining this court, in presiding over this court, in failing to advise the people that appear before him about their rights. So we seek to bring about justice in a comprehensive way in Sherwood. Justice is long overdue here for those who have survived under the terror of this court in Sherwood.
We hear a lot about the checks and balances of the American system, but there don't seem to be any checks and balances in Arkansas against practices like this, except folks like you going to court.
That's right. And the challenge is that this case could play out for a long period of time if they resist. We hope that the city of Sherwood and the county and Judge Hale will see the writing on the wall. We believe that what they have done is clearly unconstitutional, violates state law, and is just bad policy. But that's right. We have to fight case by case, and cases can take a long time to be resolved. Our hope is that we can bring national attention to this problem, that we might inspire action on the part of Congress to help step in and breathe life back into this Supreme Court ruling, which has long made clear that what they're doing in Sherwood is unconstitutional. All around our country right now, there is an important conversation happening about the over-policing of black and Latino communities and call happening for policing reform. We need to also ensure that we're looking at broken court systems like the one in Sherwood. They contribute to the problem of mass incarceration in our country. I believe that if we want a more whole justice system, that it is important that we tear down debtors' prisons like the one in place in Sherwood, Arkansas.
That was Kristen Clark, president of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, speaking from Washington.
The Obama administration this month announced it would phase out the use of private prisons in the federal penal system. Mark Maurer, executive director of the Washington-based Sentencing Project, calls the action a milestone.
Well, we've seen tremendous growth in the private prison industry since the mid-1980s. More than 120,000 people are currently incarcerated in a private prison, and the federal government has been even more aggressive than the states in using these profit-making entities. So for the Department of Justice to be making a decision at this time to turn this around and phase out the private prison industry is a real notable moment. Private prison operators didn't create mass incarceration, but they certainly contributed to it. And I think it's yet another indication that the growing critique and challenge to mass incarceration is really gaining ground now.
We've seen figures that say that about 12% of federal prisoners are in private prisons, but most of them are immigrants, and most of them, are held by Immigrations and Customs. Would they be covered by this phase-out?
No, that group of people will not be covered, and it's correct. That's a very substantial number of people and subject to many of the same problems that we see in the private prisons and the criminal system. So this has not put an end to the federal involvement in this by any means. You know, we and others are hoping that by moving in this direction in the Bureau of Prisons, hopefully there can be a spillover effect and greater consideration of doing similar things through immigration detention.
So what percentage of the Federal Bureau of Prisons, what percentage of the population would be directly affected at some point in time by this phase-out?
Well, it had been as high as 19% of people in federal prison were in a private prison not that many years ago. Now the figures we hear are more like 12%, but that's a considerable number of people, probably in the range of 20,000 or so. Now, of course, they will still be held in prison, in a federally funded and operated prison rather than a contract private prison, and none of this is to suggest that the publicly operated prisons are models of compassionate care, but they do at least avoid some of the additional problems of private prisons, and they also permit more oversight by citizens and policymakers in terms of what goes on inside.
This decision is in the nature of an executive order, which would mean that it could be reversed by the next president.
Well, that's absolutely correct. Now, Hillary Clinton has said that she wants to phase out the use of private prisons as well. That's encouraging. I don't believe Donald Trump has made a statement on this issue in particular, but it's also the case that a good deal of progress can be made just in the remaining months of the Obama administration. The Bureau of Prisons is already canceling or reducing some of the contracts it has with private prisons, so a fair amount of that, I think, would be difficult to recreate on a short-term basis. And it's also expensive, of course. If they don't need these institutions, then that's a considerable cost savings. And I think anyone in the White House would think twice before jumping into contracting again.
It might also be expensive to break a contract. Do we have a timeline of any kind?
Well, it's a process, and right, they don't want to break and they can't break a contract. So what it seems that the Justice Department is doing is as contracts expire or come up for renewal, that's how they are beginning to phase out the private prison. So I haven't seen a timeline. It wouldn't be surprising if it takes several years to work this all through, but clearly they put in motion a process by which we should be able to see that take place before too long.
Not that we're shedding any tears, but what effect has this had, and do you anticipate it will have, on the private prisons business?
Well, I think they're being very concerned now. In the first couple of hours after the announcement was made, their stock price declined about 35%. So certainly other investors are getting nervous about this. I myself, who don't know much about investing, got some outreach from financial advisors wanting to know if I could consult with some of their clients about the future of the industry, which I've not taken them up on. So I think there are indications that they are nervous about their expansion. Having said that, the private prison industry has been very aggressive in other countries as well. Australia, Scotland, Wales are just some of the places where they've been expanding to in recent years. Immigration detention, another growth area for them, and in some areas, even looking at halfway house operations and the like. So they are clearly trying to be creative in where they make their investments, and if they lose opportunities in one area, we'll probably try to make that happen in other ways.
Yes, these are, in the main, publicly traded corporations, and we know that that kind of beast must expand or die, and the logical place for expansion would be in the States.
Well, exactly. But, you know, we've seen as well in some states, at least, they've been having second thoughts about their contracts as well. Sometimes because their prison populations are declining and they can get away without further contracting. In other cases, there have been serious problems with management of the institutions, and so states have had second thoughts about whether this is a good way to run their correctional institutions. So we're starting to see some shift there, and I think the high-profile nature of the Justice Department announcement may add some additional momentum to that reconsideration in the states as well.
Of course, when we're talking about the privatization of prisons, we're not just talking about outright ownership of those facilities, but all of the services, including medical services, that are provided to one degree or another of quality to the prisons. What about that in the system?
Well, prisons are a big business. You know, the United States spends about $80 billion a year on the prison and jail system we have, and many of the services in prisons are contracted out. It may include medical care, food preparation, other kinds of services. There's nothing inherently wrong with contracting for those services, but certainly we would want to know that they're doing high quality work, that there's competitive bidding, that there's sufficient oversight by policymakers at the state level into what kinds of services are being provided and what that looks like. And, you know, many of the same kinds of problems that we've seen in private prisons generally could come up through other contracting as well. I think the burden is on the state officials who are writing and overseeing contracts to make sure that that oversight is very clear and very direct so that we don't see any abuses taking place there.
As you said, this doesn't release one prisoner from behind bars, and the federal system is far smaller than the state system. By my calculations, if the United States were to reduce its prison population to 1972 levels, and 1972 is when the growth curve in prison started going dramatically up, they would have to release 4 out of 5 prison inmates behind bars today. And although people might employ different methodologies, an 80% reduction would be about what most folks, I think, would come up with.
Well, that's certainly correct. That's just one indication of the scale of what's changed over these past 4 decades. The only good news we have there is that I think the political environment on these issues has really started to shift in recent years. There's a growing critique of mass incarceration. And at the state level, a number of states are beginning to change policies and programs to make a shift in incarceration rates. For example, we've seen 3 states, New Jersey, New York, and Rhode Island, over the last 15 years, have reduced their prison populations by more than 25%. Now, that's still a long ways from that 80% figure, but 25% is not trivial. They've done this while still maintaining reductions in crime. They've done it while maintaining political support in their state. So I think there are growing models out there that suggest that, you know, substantial reductions in prison populations are possible, and we need to keep advocating for significant reforms, not ones that will just have a relatively modest effect in this world record prison population.
But how does one achieve those substantial reductions that would really change the nature of mass incarceration in this country? Certainly not by individual case-by-case examinations.
Yeah, I think the main strategy is to address the sentencing policies, the so-called tough-on-crime policies that developed over these last several decades. We've had dramatic increases in our prison population, not because there's been a dramatic increase in crime, but because we've adopted sentencing policies specifically designed to send more people to prison and to keep them there for longer periods of time. So in various ways, mandatory sentencing policies, three strikes and you're out, cutbacks in parole, so-called truth in sentencing, all designed very consciously to enhance the scale of incarceration. So we need to have a full reconsideration and repeal, when appropriate, of many of those initiatives. A number of states are now cutting back on their mandatory sentencing policy. A state like California, which had the broadest three strikes and you're out policy, scaled that back through a voter initiative a couple of years ago, and legislation pending in Congress now at the federal level would cut back the scale at which mandatory sentencing is imposed. So we still have a long way to go, but there have been encouraging developments in the last half dozen years or so.
And what about targeting for release whole categories of prisoners, as Presidents Ford and Carter did with draft resistors, and looking at that huge geriatric population of mostly old men now rotting in jail?
Right, exactly. President Obama has stepped up the pace of sentence commutations that he's issued. He's now up to about 560 people who've had their terms cut from federal prisons. Almost all of them are drug offenders. About a third of them had been sentenced to life imprisonment. Now, in many of those cases, they're still going to serve 15 or 20 years, but not life imprisonment. One obvious area in which the president could have a big effect are for those people imprisoned for a crack cocaine offense in federal prison. In 2010, Congress scaled back the sentencing disparity between crack cocaine and powder cocaine offenses, but that disparity, that change, was not made retroactive. So there are still nearly 5,000 people in federal prison serving time for a crack offense that Congress has now decided was unfair and unjust. So the president could essentially, with a stroke of a pen, apply those new sentencing structures to this older group of people serving these sentences and reduce the amount of time that group of 5,000 is serving. And I think that could be done with strong public support. There was strong support for the reform of the crack laws, and I think very few people would object to such an action today.
And as we have discussed with you in the past, the Obama administration actually went into court to get a ruling that allowed them to retain those 5,000 crack cocaine prisoners.
Yeah, the Obama administration had been supportive of most of the reform efforts, but not every last one necessarily. I think the general direction the administration has gone in the last couple of years has been supportive of sentencing reform and reconsideration of mandatory penalties. And I think while many people had been concerned that the scale of clemencies that the president issued in his first term in office was exceedingly modest, clearly the pace has stepped up considerably, and there are promises out there that substantial additional number will get a clemency of some sort before this term is through.
But the pace of prison reform, these modest reforms on Capitol Hill, has in fact slowed down.
Well, it has, yes. And, you know, while there's no question that there's strong bipartisan support for reform, we see in the Republican-controlled House and Senate, reform legislation has been adopted by each of the judiciary committees. There's still a relative handful of senators in particular who are adamantly opposed to sentencing reform and making a lot of noise about that. The main opposition is coming from some Republican senators, and so it's a political question now about whether the party will be receptive to moving ahead, even with some opposition there, or whether we have to wait till the next year in the next Congress. It's not clear right now.
Mark Maurer of the Sentencing Project in Washington.
Mumia Abu-Jamal, the nation's best-known political prisoner, has come to some conclusions about the major party presidential candidates. He says it's a case of choose your poison.
As the campaign clock winds down to zero, the choices before the voters seem incredibly grim, especially if one is a black voter. The polls say 91% of black voters will vote for Hillary Rodham Clinton, and a scant 1% will vote for her Republican opponent, Donald J. Trump. It seems clear that the black vote, and perhaps the Latino vote, will prove decisive on who will live in the house that slaves built and rebuilt, called the White House. But in a sense, it doesn't matter who wins. For black folks, lose. For choice A means voting for an overt racist, and choice B means voting for someone who supported one of the most poisonous public policies in decades, that is, the prison industrial complex. That's because neoliberalism, in other words, Clintonism, is the politics of repression with a smile. Today's neoliberalism is yesterday's conservatism, and today's conservatism is little more than neo-fascism. And both are servants of Wall Street, which, not surprisingly, bankrolls them both. What we are seeing is the total destruction of democracy for a kind of market realism. What makes money rules. We are witnessing the rotting of capitalism, and our politics, as ugly as it is a symptom of this disease. For neoliberalism and neoconservatism equal naked corporatism. In a very real sense, Clintonism equals Trumpism, with differences in degree, not kind. In a real democracy, informed citizens vote on knowledge, not emotions. Instead, they are driven like herds of cattle from one disaster behind them to the disaster looming before them, driven from fear to hope, and from hope to new fears. Such a politics as this can only bode ill for the future.
Mumia Abu-Jamal, reporting for Prison Radio from the state prison at Ma Hanoi, Pennsylvania.
Ajamu Baraka, the veteran human rights activist and Black Agenda Report editor and columnist who's running for vice president on the Green Party ticket, says his party is determined to dismantle the U.S. policy of waging permanent war.
We believe that basically we have to address this culture of support for permanent war. We understand that permanent war is a central component of the elite agenda. They attempt to try to maintain their hegemony. We're talking about basically the white male minority in the U.S. and in Western Europe that are still in power and still attempting to try to maintain their dominance. Within the context of U.S. policy, we know that the national security strategy created right at the turn of the new century, adopted by the Bush administration, in which the objective was to basically engage in what they call full spectrum dominance. That is, the U.S. will be hegemonic throughout the entire planet, and they will use military means to, in fact, do that. That policy continues. It was adopted and embraced by the Obama administration, and it is a policy that is also embraced by Hillary Clinton. That's part of the elite agenda. It says that, for example, they're not going to allow any development of a regional power that could threaten their hegemony. Thus, they have the pivot to China to confront the Chinese. They have already engaged in isolation politically and economically of Russia. They moved on Syria after they had made the mistake of dislodging Saddam Hussein, looking at it from their point of view, and allowing for the increased power of the Iranians. So they had to counter that by basically then subverting Syria. So this is the strategy. And to buttress their military strategy, they have this economic strategy, and that is these enormous so-called free trade agreements with the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. That's the economic arm of this full spectrum dominance component. Attempted to isolate China and Asia, bringing in all of these various Asian countries closer, integrating them closer into the American economy, undermining their dependence on the Chinese for cheap labor. And the same thing is happening with their attempt to try to pass the transatlantic investment partnership with Europe. This is all part of their process of trying to maintain their hegemony. And so this is what we have to fight against. With the Obama administration, the anti-war movement basically dwindled down to almost nothing. There's still some very courageous people who are holding up the banner of being opposed to war and interventions. But they are being offset by this strange positions taken by many people who call themselves leftists, who seem, Kevin, they can't find a U.S. intervention that they can oppose.
That they don't like.
You know, it's really strange. And so for the first time, we've had numbers of so-called leftists who are on the same side of the American state. And as you indicated in your question, what is the justification? Well, they have this thing called humanitarian interventionism and the responsibility to protect. This is nothing but the policy manifestation of the 21st century version of the white man's burden, that these European countries have a God-given right to intervene into the affairs of countries around the world, to police the entire planet, to determine what governments are legitimate or not, to determine who lives or dies. That is arrogance that has to be confronted. But that becomes the ideological and the moral justification for American interventionism. And the fact that you have people on the left who support that, who find themselves on the same side of the American state, it's been one of the strangest phenomenons over the last decade and a half. It really is. And they justify that by, you know, saying that the U.S. is dislodging dictators or whatever. But I ask the question, when was the last time the U.S. has ever been on the side of the people in reality? And the answer is never.
Green Party presidential candidate Ajamu Baraka speaking with Kevin Pina at Pacifica radio station KPFA in Berkeley, California.
A writer named Carrie Burke recently posted an article in the supposedly left-wing magazine In These Times claiming that U.S. anti-war organizations are wrong in opposing the U.S.-backed jihadist war against Syria. Burke claims the anti-war groups are somehow behaving like imperialists. She attacked a long list of activists and organizations, including UNAC, the United National Anti-War Coalition. Bar editor and senior columnist Margaret Kimberly is on the administrative committee of UNAC.
It's just not logical, is the response. UNAC is steadfast in opposing American intervention abroad. And that means we must oppose the intervention of the five-year-long war of terror waged against the people and the country of a nation of Syria. These people who are otherwise consider themselves leftists, but yet go right along with the most basic arguments for intervention is, well, it's interesting, I will say that. Of course, the United States and other NATO nations don't attack countries and then say anything good about those countries or their leaders. They have to claim a responsibility to protect. They have to say that Assad is like Hitler. They have to say Assad must go. They have to go on and on about barrel bombs. I don't know what makes a barrel bomb different from any other bomb. But people in Syria who oppose Assad, people in any country in the world who oppose their leadership, must figure out their own ways of changing their system or getting rid of their leaders, which is not an easy task, but it is never the responsibility of an outside party to make those changes, particularly the NATO, the U.S., Saudi Arabia, the Gulf monarchies, Israel, Turkey. This is a rogues gallery of countries and forces which always act with the most base motives. They don't care about human rights anywhere in the world. They want to kill off secular governments in the Arab world, and they have been doing that, unfortunately, successfully, picking them off one by one. They want to use jihadists to do this, who then turn around and attack them. So it's a 40-year-long history of various kinds of blowback, and not to mention just human suffering. There are 9 million Syrians displaced, 400,000 people dead, all because of the bad actors, and they must be condemned. And we also must condemn people who try to find some weasel words to, in effect, defend them.
Terry Burke somehow lives in an alternative universe in which we don't hear the voices of the anti-government people of Syria, but only the pro-government peoples of Syria. That seems to be actually the exact opposite of the reality in the United States.
Yes, she was moved to write this piece in response to a rally that UNAC held here in New York a few months ago, and there were Syrians at that rally. I don't think it's accurate to say whether some were pro or anti-Assad. They are pro-Syrian, and they're opposed to intervention, and they're opposed to the destruction of their country. Yes, some of them carried the Syrian flag. So what? That's their right. Some of them had a flag with Assad's image on the flag. So what? That's their right. But she goes on and on about a U.S.-centric point of view when there were clearly Syrians there, making clear their opposition to this intervention, which is destroying their country and killing their people. So Terry Burke and others, they have a list of acceptable Syrians can be listened to. And anyone not on that list is censored, should be ignored. And anyone else who is not part of that acceptable group is pro-Assad and can be ignored. So basically, these people, for all their talk of I was an activist and I was against this war and that war, at the end of the day, they are not opposed to U.S. intervention. They are pro-imperialism as long as the right language is used. If you attack a person or a leader like Assad in the cleverest way, using the best propaganda, they can march right along with NATO and the U.S. and the Saudis. I mean, talk about undemocratic Saudi Arabia. I mean, my God, they never mention that, by the way, in their criticism of those of us who attack imperialism. They never talk about the people who are on the other side because they're not defensible. So you can't write something even as logical as it is. You can't talk about the fact that Saudi Arabia paid terrorists to infiltrate Syria and destroy that country.
Terry Burke seems to represent those people who called themselves anti-war but have shown that they are pro so-called humanitarian intervention.
Pro any intervention run by a Democratic president. And Democrats differ from Republicans only, I think, in the language that they use. So if Barack Obama invades, not directly with U.S. troops, but directs interventions in Libya and Syria, they find a way to defend it. When Bill Clinton destroyed Yugoslavia and tore that country apart, they found a way to defend it, and the corporate media help, and they always turn someone into a villain and say that Milosevic was a war criminal. He wasn't. Gaddafi is a war criminal. He wasn't. Assad is a war criminal. He's not. Who, by the way, has been reelected during this time that the West is trying to pick his country apart. People went to the polls and supported him and supported his efforts to defend their nation. But these people, yeah, they're more anti-Republican, they're more Democrats, they're more liberal than they really are on the left, and more than they're really anti-war. So we see that if the right person and the right language is used, they can go right along with the U.S. government and its terrorism of other countries.
And it should be obvious to any honest observer that if the Assad government has been able to hang on for the last 5 years against the forces of NATO and all of these billionaire royalty of the Arab world, it's because he has the support of most of the population.
Yes, obviously. I mean, this would be a perfect opportunity for people if they, as Terry Brooke and others claim, this would have been a perfect opportunity for people to rise up, or even his own military to rise up and get rid of him. Instead of standing together to fight people who have invaded their country. And I also want to mention ISIS. You know, the United States uses ISIS and other has a 40-year history of using these jihadist groups to do their dirty work. ISIS thrives every place where the United States has intervened, Iraq, Libya, Syria. So for all the talk of fighting ISIS, it's phony. There was no fight against ISIS until Russia finally decided to come in about a year ago.
I wonder which war Terry Burke would be opposed to.
You know, that's a good question. I don't know. This should meet for someone who calls themselves anti-war, for someone who calls herself a leftist. This should, by any criteria, be something that she opposes. So it's hard to say what she would oppose. I think perhaps if it was a Republican instead of a Democrat, if there was a George Bush, if Mitt Romney were president instead of Obama, maybe then she would be opposed to the intervention. But I think there's just a lot of confusion, and there's a lot of just phoniness among people who call themselves anti-war and people who call themselves leftists. At times like this, we see who really is on the left. And this is very basic. This is leftism 101, to say that imperialist nations cannot just have their way and decide who's going to run Syria and tear the country apart to make sure they get the government that they want. This seems to me very basic. But as we've seen, this is not the first time. We have seen that a lot of people who claim to be leftists really are just liberals. They really are Democrats. They will be against a Republican president, but not a Democrat. And I think in the end, they want to be flag wavers. They want to go along the U.S. history of manifest destiny. And we see it at times like this in this five-year-long war against Syria.
Terry Burke's thinking isn't too organized, but she is rather thorough in those she denounces, which range from UNAC and Workers' World and Answer to folks like Patrick Cockburn and Robert Kennedy Jr. She seems to have declared her own war against everybody that's to the left of the current administration.
Yeah, that's the insidious part of this, and that's why the UNAC Administrative Committee, of which I'm a member, and that's why we felt it was so important to respond, and some of the other organizations who were attacked have responded directly to her. It's important that we not allow ourselves to be smeared as people who don't care about human life, as people who support dictatorships. And that we answer those who say things that are not true and who misrepresent an entire movement, who misrepresent the anti-war movement, who misrepresent left-wing principles, because we have to know who our friends are, who our allies are. And at this stage in history, with the United States and its allies poised to attack pretty much any part of the world they want to, it's important for us to take a stand, even rhetorically, and counter these attacks whenever they crop up.
That was Margaret Kimberly of the United National Anti-War Coalition and also an editor and senior columnist with Black Agenda Report.
In the same week that guerrillas in the South American nation of Colombia signed a peace agreement with that country's government, in the Philippines, communist guerrillas of the New People's Army wrapped up the first phase of negotiations to end their nearly 50-year rebellion in that former American colony. We spoke with Bernadette Ellerin, the chairperson of BIAN USA, which represents the armed resistance in the Philippines. We asked her what prompted the breakthrough.
One different condition that contributed greatly to the advance of the peace process is the election of Rodrigo Duterte as president of the Philippines. Historically, President Duterte, when he was mayor of Davao City, has shown respect, demonstrated a recognition of the People's Democratic Government set up, established by the revolutionary forces in the country, and he's worked in cooperation with the revolutionary forces as well as mayor. And I think he's taken that same practice now as president and has actually implemented confidence-building measures to create a favorable climate for the peace process, which has been stalled for 15 years, to continue. I think that's one of the major contributing factors to being able to the success of the first round of the peace process right now.
Yes, it's been said that Duterte has called himself a socialist. Do you think he'll have any problem reining in his police and his military?
Well, President Duterte was elected not as the usual U.S. handpicked candidate of the Philippines. The Philippines is a neo-colony, and traditional politics illustrate that in order to become the president of the Philippines, you have to be handpicked by the U.S. So President Duterte is not the handpicked candidate of the U.S. However, he is still the president of a U.S. neo-colony. And I think that in itself explains a lot of complexities and nuances in the current situation. The whole machinery of the Philippine government is still more or less aligned with the U.S. imperialist dictates, including especially the Philippine military. The armed forces of the Philippines has historically been a mercenary army funded by the U.S., a proxy army for the U.S. to basically do its dirty work and to kill off the longest armed revolution against U.S. imperialism in the region, which is the Philippine Revolution, which it has been unable to do. So I think Putin Duterte has a lot to balance as the new chief executive of the country, given that situation.
And although foreign bases are illegal now in the Philippines, the U.S. in fact does operate bases there, and U.S. special forces are active.
Yes, the Philippines has never ceased to be a military stronghold for the U.S. It's crucial to U.S. geopolitical strategy in the region to have its bases in the Philippines. It's the gateway to Asia. It's in the South China Sea, and that is a gateway for a lot of shipping lanes and trading routes that are crucial to the U.S. economy. The U.S.'s largest export position is in the Asia-Pacific region, and the Philippines is. And having bases in that region, particularly in the Philippines, is crucial to the U.S. economy.
And I would assume that what's crucial to the success of these peace talks is a prompt release of many of the hundreds of prisoners that are being held.
Yes, and to his credit, President Duterte did release a number of NDFP consultants who were illegally detained for years, top leaders of the Communist Party, to be able to participate in the talks. This is a confidence-building measure in order to move the peace process forward. There are still at least 580 more political prisoners that are linked to the NDFP that have yet to be released. But one of the agreements that came out of this first round of talk was an agreement for a general amnesty to release all political prisoners linked to the National Democratic Party of the Philippines upon the peace panel's return to the Philippines.
The United States decades ago put the armed resistance on a list of international terrorists, which went a long way to poisoning any chance of negotiations. Do you think the U.S. might follow Duterte's lead and withdraw that designation?
No, I don't think so, because the U.S. just renewed earlier this year. It's the terrorist listing of the Communist Party, the New People's Army. And the chief political consultant for the NDFP, Jose Maria Sison. So I think this basically demonstrates that the U.S. government is intent on frustrating the peace process.
If the National Democratic Front is to operate above ground, it will need to be assured that its members won't be assassinated, either by police or by other militias.
Yes, there needs to be some assurance that the NDFP consultants, while the peace process has been renewed and is pushing forward, are protected. And actually, one of the agreements that came out years ago that has been violated by the Philippine government is an agreement called the Joint Agreement on Immunity and Security Guarantees, or the JASIG for short. It's an acronym. And it basically stipulates that both parties in the peace process are protected and especially on the side of the revolutionary government, the consultants are protected from arrest and from detention for as long as the peace process is moving forward. But yes, historically, the Philippine government has unleashed bloody counterinsurgency campaigns that target not only the revolutionary forces, but also the mass movement, the civilian mass movement, because the National Democratic Movement in the Philippines is not just on the countryside, it's also in the cities and in the urban centers and operates also above ground, represented by Bayan. So many members of Bayan and its member organizations have been killed by the Philippine military because of these U.S.-crafted counterinsurgency campaigns. So one of the focuses now for the peace process to move forward is for these counterinsurgency campaigns to end, because right now there is still an active counterinsurgency campaign that was started by the previous president that President Duterte has yet to completely put an end to. The killings are still continuing, in other words.
And what about the social services that the resistance has provided, especially in outlying areas? Would they continue?
Yes, absolutely, because the people's war being waged by the revolutionary forces is not just a shooting war. It is a war that engages in base building and agrarian revolution. So in the context of the base building, the New People's Army basically provides services and also have been establishing a revolutionary government in the countryside, in the far-flung regions, amongst the poorest, amongst those who are the most marginalized. They've established, mainly on a barrio and municipality level, a people's democratic government that operates in 71 out of 81 of the provinces in the country. And so there is a revolutionary government established by the Communist Party of the Philippines that exists. There are two states in the Philippines, and these are the two states that are at war and also negotiating with each other right now. In terms of the services, the New People's Army offers healthcare, offers education services, offers counseling services, engages in agricultural production, provides basic survival skill sharing, also has schools set up in the far-flung regions for indigenous communities in Mindanao, where the Department of Education does not provide those basic services because they're very marginalized and they're too far-flung for the local government units to even make an effort to go to. So yes, these are the basic services provided by the revolutionary forces, especially by the New People's Army.
And would you think that Duterte's government would tolerate a parallel government? Or could he, as he has intimated, operate in coalition in those areas with the other government?
I think Duterte is definitely seeking a coalition government. The revolutionary forces are open to cooperation. One of Duterte's statements has been that he wants to implement a system of federalism in the country, which the revolutionary forces are still studying to see how this would be implemented and how this would impact the people. I think for as long as the Duterte government is in power, there are definitely hope for cooperation.
Well, do you worry about Duterte's government and what the United States might do to destabilize it, especially in light of these accords?
Yes, that's a legitimate concern. The U.S. is very intent on protecting its interests, which is to remain the neocolonial power of the Philippines, and it will use any means it has, and especially the directing the Philippine military to ensure it has its position. So, yes. Definitely, that's a major concern. It's also one of the points of the peace negotiations. Duterte has also made some really strong pronouncements to the media on his criticism of U.S. imperialism in the country. So, I mean, a lot has yet to be seen if this will play out in policy, past proclamations. The U.S. and the Philippines signed a new defense pact 2 years ago that would basically allow the building of more U.S. military facilities in the country. It's called the Enhanced Defense Cooperation Agreement, or the EDCA for short. We are urging President Duterte, as the chief executive in the country, to scrap this policy as soon as possible, because even when he was mayor of Davao City years ago, he demonstrated on a policy level not allowing the U.S. to build drone centers in his city and his criticism of U.S. intervention in Mindanao. So we're hoping this will also translate on a presidential level.
President Duterte is getting some very, very bad press here in the United States based on his drug policies or his anti-drug policies.
Yes, he is. And for the record, Bayan and the revolutionary forces have gone on record to also criticize President Duterte for his vigilante tactics in pursuing a so-called war on drugs by not pursuing due process when ascertaining alleged dealers of drugs amongst the poor. It really is rooted in the basic poverty issue in the country. And right now, the corporate media is having a field day in fanning the flames of this issue to basically create the public narrative that Duterte is basically a dictator, when in fact he has demonstrated being a pro-people politician in the sense of on a policy level. But we also agree that he needs to enact due process in terms of addressing the drug problem in the country. And even so, the targets for his war are the poor. They're not even the oligarchs who are behind the problem. So that in itself is a major concern that must be addressed through alleviating the basic framework of poverty in the country, which is deepening and growing because of neoliberal economic policies, mainly coming from the United States. The Western press, as dictated by the U.S. government, is doing its best to really destabilize Duterte's image and character assassinate him. I think recently a reporter from CNN questioned him publicly at a press conference regarding his war on drugs, the extrajudicial killings, and Duterte had a very valid point when he said, what's the difference between that and all the killings of black people in the U.S.? What's the difference between that and the bombings in Syria? Why isn't the Western media condemning those actions? Why isn't the U.S. government condemning those actions? Why are they focusing on what's happening in the Philippines? Which I think is a valid point. Duterte is basically throwing the ball back to the Western media that to not be hypocritical about understanding the human rights situation in the Philippines under his administration, while at the same time ignoring the grave human rights violations of the U.S. government.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.